Sansa. The throne room was a sea of jewels, furs, and bright fabrics. Lords and ladies filled the back of the hall and stood beneath the high windows, jostling like fishwives on a dock. The denizens of Joffrey's court had striven to outdo each other today. Jalabar Zoe was all in feathers, a plumage so fantastic and extravagant that he seemed like to take flight. The High Septon's crystal crown fired rainbows through the air every time he moved his head. At the council table, Queen Cersei shimmered in a cloth of gold gown slashed in burgundy velvet, while beside her Varys fussed and simpered in a lilac brocade. Moonboy and Sedontas wore new suits of motley, clean as a spring morning. Even Lady Tanda and her daughters looked pretty in matching gowns of turquoise silk and vair, and Lord Giles was coughing into a square of scarlet silk trimmed with golden lace. King Joffrey sat above them all, amidst the blades and barbs of the Iron Throne. He was in crimson samite, his black mantle studded with rubies, on his head his heavy golden crown. Squirming through a press of knights, squires, and rich townfolk, Sansa reached the front of the gallery just as a blast of trumpets announced the entry of Lord Tywin Lannister. He rode his warhorse down the length of the hall and dismounted before the Iron Throne. Sansa had never seen such armor, all burnished red steel, inlaid with golden scrollwork and ornamentation. His rundles were sunbursts. The roaring lion that crowned his helm had ruby eyes, and a lioness on each shoulder fastened a cloth of gold cloak so long and heavy that it draped the hindquarters of his charger. Even the horse's armor was gilded, and his bardings were shimmering crimson silk emblazoned with the lion of Lannister. The Lord of Castle Rock made such an impressive figure that it was a shock when his destrier dropped a load of dung right at the base of the throne. Joffrey had to step gingerly around it as he descended to embrace his grandfather and proclaim him savior of the city. Sansa covered her mouth to hide a nervous smile. Joff made a show of asking his grandfather to assume governance of the realm, and Lord Tywin solemnly accepted the responsibility, "until your grace does come of age." Then squires removed his armor, and Joff fastened the hand's chain of office around his neck. Lord Tywin took a seat at the council table beside the queen. After the destrier was led off and his homage removed, Cersei nodded for the ceremonies to continue. A fanfare of brazen trumpets greeted each of the heroes as he stepped between the great oak doors. Heralds cried his name and deeds for all to hear, and the noble knights and highborn ladies cheered as lustily as cutthroats at a cockfight. Pride of place was given to Mace Tyrell, the Lord of Highgarden, a once powerful man gone to fat, yet still handsome. His sons followed him in, Sir Loras and his older brother, Sir Garland the Gallant. The three dressed alike in green velvet trimmed with sable. The king descended the throne once more to greet them, a great honor. He fastened about the throat of each a chain of roses wrought in soft yellow gold, from which hung a golden disc with the lion of Lannister picked out in rubies. "The roses support the lion, as the might of Highgarden supports the realm," proclaimed Joffrey. "If there is any boon you would ask of me, ask, and it shall be yours." "And now it comes," thought Sansa. "Your grace," said Sir Loras, "I beg the honor of serving in your king's guard to defend you against your enemies." Joffrey drew the knight of flowers to his feet and kissed him on his cheek. "Done, brother." Lord Tyrell bowed his head. "There is no greater pleasure than to serve the king's grace. If I were deemed worthy to join your royal council, you will find none more loyal or true." Joff put a hand on Lord Tyrell's shoulder and kissed him when he stood. "Your wish is granted." Sir Garland Tyrell, 5 years senior to Sir Loras, was a taller, bearded version of his more famous younger brother. He was thicker about the chest and broader at the shoulders, and though his face was comely enough, he lacked Sir Loras's startling beauty. "Your Grace," Garland said when the king approached him, "I have a maiden sister, Margery, the delight of our house. She was to wed Renly Baratheon, as you know, but Lord Renly went to war before the marriage could be consummated, so she remains innocent. Margery has heard tales of your wisdom, courage, and chivalry, and has come to love you from afar. I beseech you to send for her, to take her hand in marriage, and to wed your house to mine for all time." King Joffrey made a show of looking surprised. "Sir Garland, your sister's beauty is famed throughout the Seven Kingdoms, but I am promised to another. A king must keep his word." Queen Cersei got to her feet in a rustle of skirts. "Your Grace, in the judgment of your small council, it would be neither proper nor wise for you to wed the daughter of a man beheaded for treason, a girl whose brother is in open rebellion against the throne even now. Sir, your councillors beg you, for the good of your realm, set Sansa Stark aside. The Lady Margery will make you a far more suitable queen." Like a pack of trained dogs, the lords and ladies in the hall began to shout their pleasure. "Margery," they called, "give us Margery!" And, "No traitor queens! Tyrell! Tyrell!" Joffrey raised a hand. "I would like to heed the wishes of my people, mother, but I took a holy vow." The High Septon stepped forward. "Your Grace, the guards hold betrothal solemn, but your father, King Robert of blessed memory, made this pact before the Starks of Winterfell had revealed their falseness. Their crimes against the realm have freed you from any promise you might have made. So far as the faith is concerned, there is no valid marriage contract betwixt you and Sansa Stark." A tumult of cheering filled the throne room, and cries of "Margery! Margery!" erupted all around her. Sansa leaned forward, her hands tight around the gallery's wooden rail. She knew what came next, but she was still frightened of what Joffrey might say, afraid that he would refuse to release her even now, when his whole kingdom depended upon it. She felt as if she were back again, on the marble steps outside the great sept of Baelor, waiting for her prince to grant her father mercy, and instead hearing him command Ilion Payne to strike off his head. "Please," she prayed fervently, "make him say it. Make him say it." Lord Tywin was looking at his grandson. Joffrey gave him a sullen glance, shifted his feet, and helped Sir Garland Tyrell to rise. "The guards are good. I am free to heed my heart. I will wed your sweet sister, and gladly, sir." He kissed Sir Garland on a bearded cheek as the cheers rose all around them. Sansa felt curiously light-headed. "I am free." She could feel eyes upon her. "I must not smile," she reminded herself. The queen had warned her, no matter what she felt inside, the face she showed the world must look distraught. "I will not have my son humiliated," Cersei said. "Do you hear me?" "Yes, but if I am not to be queen, what will become of me?" "That will need to be determined. For the moment, you shall remain here at court as our ward." "I want to go home." The queen was irritated by that. "You should have learned by now, none of us get the things we want." "I have, though," Sansa thought. "I am free of Joffrey. I will not have to kiss him, nor give him my maidenhood, nor bear him children. Let Margaery Tyrell have all that, poor girl." By the time the outburst died down, the Lord of Highgarden had been seated at the council table, and his sons had joined the other knights and lordlings beneath the windows. Sansa tried to look forlorn and abandoned as other heroes of the Battle of the Blackwater were summoned forth to receive their rewards. Paxter Redwine, Lord of the Arbor, marched down the length of the hall flanked by his twin sons, Horror and Slubber, the former limping from a wound taken in the battle. After them followed Lord Mathis Rowan, in a snowy doublet with a great tree worked upon the breast in gold thread. Lord Randall Tarley, lean and balding, a great sword across his back in a jewel scabbard. Sir Kevin Lannister, a thick-set balding man with a close-trimmed beard. Sir Adam Marbrand, coppery hair streaming to his shoulders. The great Western lords, Lyddon, Crakehall, and Brax. Next came four of lesser birth who had distinguished themselves in the fighting. The one-eyed knight, Sir Philip Foote, who had slain Lord Bryce Caron in single combat. The free rider, Lothar Brun, who cut his way through half a hundred fussaway men-at-arms to capture Sir John of the Green Apple and kill Sir Brian and Sir Edward of the Red, thereby winning himself the name Lothar Apple-Eater. Willett, a grizzled man-at-arms in the service of Sir Harry Swift, who pulled his master from beneath his dying horse and defended him against a dozen attackers, and a downy-cheeked squire named Josmin Peckledon, who had killed two knights, wounded a third, and captured two more, though he could not have been more than 14. Willett was borne in on a litter, so grievous were his wounds. Sir Kevin had taken a seat beside his brother, Lord Tywin. When the herald had finished telling of each hero's deeds, he rose. "It is his grace's wish that these good men be rewarded for their valour. By his decree, Sir Philip shall henceforth be Lord Philip of House Foote, and to him shall go all the lands, rights, and incomes of House Caron. Lothar Brun to be raised to the estate of knighthood, and granted lands and keep in the riverlands at War's End. To Josmin Peckledon, a sword and suit of plate, his choice of any war horse in the royal stables, and knighthood as soon as he shall come of age. And lastly, for Goodman Willett, a spear with a silver banded haft, a hauberk of new forged ringmail, and a full helm with visor. Further, the good man's sons shall be taken into the service of House Lannister at Casterly Rock, the elder as a squire and the younger as a page, with a chance to advance to knighthood if they serve loyally and well. To all this, the king's hand and the small council consent." The captains of the king's warships, Wildwind, Prince Aemon, and River Arrow, were honoured next, along with some under-officers from God's Grace, Lance, Lady of Silk, and Ram's Head. As near as Sansa could tell, their chief accomplishment had been surviving the battle on the river, a feat that few enough could boast. Halin the Pyromancer and the Masters of the Alchemist Guild received the king's thanks as well, and Halin was raised to the style of Lord, though Sansa noted that neither lands nor castle accompanied the title, which made the alchemist no more a true lord than Varys was. A more significant lordship by far was granted to Sir Lancel Lannister. Joffrey awarded him the lands, castle, and rights of House Dairy, whose last child lord had perished during the fighting in the Riverlands, leaving no true-born heirs of lawful Dairy blood, but only a bastard cousin. Sir Lancel did not appear to accept the title. The talk was his wound might cost him his arm or even his life. The imp was said to be dying as well, from a terrible cut to the head. When the herald called, "Lord Petar Baelish," he came forth, dressed all in shades of rose and plum, his cloak patterned with mockingbirds. She could see him smiling as he knelt before the Iron Throne. He looked so pleased. Sansa had not heard of Littlefinger doing anything especially heroic during the battle, but it seemed he was to be rewarded all the same. Sir Kevin got back to his feet. "It is the wish of the King's Grace that his loyal counsellor, Petar Baelish, be rewarded for faithful service to crown and realm. Be it known that Lord Baelish is granted the castle of Harrenhal, with all its attendant lands and incomes, there to make his seat and rule henceforth, as Lord Paramount of the Trident. Petar Baelish and his sons and grandsons shall hold and enjoy these honours until the end of time, and all the lords of the Trident shall do him homage as their rightful liege. The king's hand and the small council consent." On his knees, Littlefinger raised his eyes to King Joffrey. "I thank you humbly, Your Grace. I suppose this means I'll need to see about getting some sons and grandsons." Joffrey laughed, and the court with him. Lord Paramount of the Trident, Sansa thought, and Lord of Harrenhal as well. She did not understand why that should make him so happy. The honours were as empty as the title granted to Hailyn the Pyromancer. Harrenhal was cursed. Everyone knew that, and the Lannisters did not even hold it at present. Besides, the Lords of the Trident were sworn to Riverrun and House Tully, and to the King in the North. They would never accept Littlefinger as their liege. Unless they are made to. Unless my brother and my uncle and my grandfather are all cast down and killed. The thought made Sansa anxious, but she told herself she was being silly. Rob has beaten them every time. He'll beat Lord Baelish too, if he must. More than 600 new knights were made that day. They had held their vigil in the great Sept of Baelor all through the night, and crossed the city barefoot that morning to prove their humble hearts. Now they came forward, dressed in shifts of undyed wool, to receive their knighthoods from the King's Guard. It took a long time, since only three of the Brothers of the White Sword were on hand to dub them. Mandan Moore had perished in the battle. The Hound had vanished. Aerys Oakheart was in Dorne with Princess Mycella, and Jaime Lannister was Robb's captive. So the King's Guard had been reduced to Balon Swan, Meryn Trant, and Osmond Kettleblack. Once knighted, each man rose, buckled on his sword belt, and stood beneath the windows. Some had bloody feet from their walk through the city, but they stood tall and proud all the same, it seemed to Sansa. By the time all the new knights had been given their sirs, the hall was growing restive, and none more so than Joffrey. Some of those in the gallery had begun to slip quietly away, but the notables on the floor were trapped, unable to depart without the king's leave. Judging by the way he was fidgeting atop the Iron Throne, Joff would willingly have granted it, but the day's work was far from done. For now, the coin was turned over, and the captives were ushered in. There were great lords and noble knights in that company, too. Sir old Lord Celtigar, the Red Crab, Sir Bonifer the Good, Lord Estamont, more ancient even than Celtigar, Lord Varna, who hobbled the length of the hall on a shattered knee but would accept no help, Sir Mark Mullendore, grey-faced, his left arm gone to the elbow, Fierce Red Runnet of Griffin Roost, Sir Dermot of the Rainwood, Lord Willem and his sons, Joshua and Elias, Sir John Fussaway, Sir Timon the Scrapesword, Orain the Bastard of Driftmark, Lord Stademan, called Pennylover, hundreds of others. Those who had changed their allegiance during the battle needed only to swear fealty to Joffrey, but the ones who had fought for Stannis until the bitter end were compelled to speak. Their words decided their fate. If they begged forgiveness for their treasons and promised to serve loyally henceforth, Joffrey welcomed them back into the king's peace and restored them to all their lands and rights. A handful remained defiant, however.
"Do not imagine this is done, boy,"
warned one, the bastard son of some Florent or other.
"The Lord of Light protects King Stannis, now and always. All your swords and all your scheming shall not save you when his hour comes."
"Your hour is come right now." Joffrey beckoned to Sir Ilyen Payne to take the man out and strike his head off. But no sooner had that one been dragged away than a knight of solemn mien, with a fiery heart on his surcoat, shouted out,
"Stannis is the true king. A monster sits the Iron Throne, an abomination born of incest."
"Be silent," Sir Kevin Lannister bellowed.
The knight raised his voice instead.
"Joffrey is the black worm eating the heart of the realm. Darkness was his father and death his mother. Destroy him before he corrupts you all. Destroy them all, Queen Whore and King Worm, Vile Dwarf and Whispering Spider, the False Flowers. Save yourselves!" One of the gold cloaks knocked the man off his feet, but he continued to shout, "The scouring fire will come! King Stannis will return!"
Joffrey lurched to his feet.
"I'm king! Kill him! Kill him now! I command it!"
He chopped down with his hand, a furious, angry gesture, and screeched in pain when his arm brushed against one of these sharp metal fangs that surrounded him. The bright crimson samite of his sleeve turned a darker shade of red as his blood soaked through it.
"Mother!"
he wailed. With every eye on the king, somehow the man on the floor wrestled a spear away from one of the gold cloaks and used it to push himself back up to his feet.
"The throne denies him," he cried. "He is no king."
Cersei was running toward the throne, but Lord Tywin remained still as a stone. He had only to raise a finger, and Sir Meron Trant moved forward with drawn sword. The end was quick and brutal. The gold cloaks seized the knight by the arms.
"No king!"
he cried again, as Sir Meron drove the point of his long sword through his chest. Joff fell into his mother's arms. Three maesters came hurrying forward to bundle him out through the king's door. Then everyone began talking at once. When the gold cloaks dragged off the dead man, he left a trail of bright blood across the stone floor. Lord Baelish stroked his beard while Varys whispered in his ear. "Will they dismiss us now?" Sansa wondered. A score of captives still waited, though whether to pledge fealty or shout curses, who could say? Lord Tywin rose to his feet.
"We continue,"
he said, in a clear, strong voice that silenced the murmurs.
"Those of you who wish to ask pardon for their treasons may do so. We will have no more follies."
He moved to the Iron Throne and there seated himself on a step a mere 3 feet off the floor. The light outside the windows was fading by the time the session drew to a close. Sansa felt limp with exhaustion as she made her way down from the gallery. She wondered how badly Joffrey had cut himself. They say the Iron Throne can be perilous cruel to those who are not meant to sit it. Back in the safety of her own chambers, she hugged a pillow to her face to muffle a squeal of joy.
"Oh, gods be good, he did it! He put me aside in front of everyone!"
When a serving girl brought her supper, she almost kissed her. There was hot bread and fresh churned butter, a thick beef soup, capon and carrots, and peaches in honey.
"Even the food tastes sweeter," she thought.
Come dark, she slipped into a cloak and left for the Guardswood. Sir Osmond Kettleblack was guarding the drawbridge in his white armour. Sansa tried her best to sound miserable as she bid him a good evening. From the way he leered at her, she was not sure she had been wholly convincing. Dantos waited in the leafy moonlight.
"Why so sad-faced?"
Sansa asked him gaily.
"You were there, you heard. Joff put me aside. He's done with me, he's..."
He took a hand.
"Oh, Junkle, my poor Junkle, you do not understand. Done with ye? They've scarcely begun."
Her heart sank.
"What do you mean?"
"The Queen will never let ye go, never. You're too valuable a hostage. And Joffrey, sweetling, is still king. If he wants you in his bed, he will have you. Only now it will be bastards he plants in your womb instead of true-born sons."
"No,"
Sansa said, shocked.
"He let me go, he..."
Sir Dantos planted a slobbery kiss on her ear.
"Be brave. I swore to see you home. And now I can. The day has been chosen."
"When?" Sansa asked. "When will we go?"
"The night of Joffrey's wedding. After the feast. All the necessary arrangements have been made. The Red Keep will be full of strangers. Half the court will be drunk, and the other half will be helping Joffrey to bed his bride. For a little while, you will be forgotten, and the confusion will be our friend."
"The wedding won't be for a moon's turn yet," Marjorie Tyrell is at High Garden. They've only now sent for her.
You've waited so long. Be patient a while longer. Here, I have something for you.
Sir Dantas fumbled in his pouch and drew out a silvery spiderweb, dangling it between his thick fingers. It was a hairnet of fine-spun silver, the strand so thin and delicate, the net seemed to weigh no more than a breath of air when Sansa took it in her fingers. Small gems were set wherever two strands crossed, so dark they drank the moonlight. What stones are these?
Black amethyst, from Ashai, the rarest kind, a deep true purple by daylight.
It's very lovely, Sansa said, thinking,
it is a ship I need, not a net for my hair.
Lovelier than you know, sweet child. It's magic, you see. It's justice you hold. It's vengeance for your father.
Dantas leaned close and kissed her again.
It's home.